Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Michael Phillips. Do you see the woman in the window? Do you see the woman in the window?
Yeah.
So I want you to see that woman because that's my wife. But that's not my apartment.
We're pretty sure that's not how Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro met. Scorsese there as the homicidally jealous husband in his own Taxi Driver, one of eight films that he and De Niro have made together. This week's Film Spotting Top 5, actor-director pairings.
We've also got a review of the confounding new thriller Enemy, Denis Villeneuve's follow-up to last year's Prisoners, and his second film in a row with Jake Gyllenhaal. That and more.
You talking to me, Michael? I'm the only one here.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over a million high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level.
For 25% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use offer code FILM314.
You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune sitting in for Adam. We'll get to our lists of the top five actor-director pairings in a bit.
But first, the psychological thriller Enemy gives Jake Gyllenhaal a chance to test his acting chops against Jake Gyllenhaal.
Maybe we're brothers.
We're not brothers.
We're not brothers.
How do you know?
Do you have a scar on your chest? This one? You do, don't you? When's your birthday?
This is a bad idea.
I think I made a mistake here.
That's Jake Gyllenhaal acting opposite Jake Gyllenhaal in the new movie Enemy. He's playing both Adam and Anthony there. And this is a classic doppelganger premise. The movie has an ending that is guaranteed to divide audiences, I think, into three camps. The what the hell camp, the laugh out loud camp, and the laugh out loud and then what the hell camp. So that's what I think. We're going to deal with all kinds of spoiler issues, especially about that ending, in the bonus content on this show. But for now, let's just say that Enemy is one of two films made back-to-back starring Jake Gyllenhaal, working for the director Denis Villeneuve, who made Prisoners, and before that, the fantastic movie Incendies. And in Enemy, Gyllenhaal plays a history professor, an introverted type, one night watching a movie on DVD, and he spies in the margins of this film an actor playing a bit part who could be his exact double. The movie then introduces us to this other Jake. He's an actor, brash and confident, very different personality type. And what happens next in Enemy? Well, that's a riddle when these two eventually meet. We can't really talk about the spoiler issues with it, but we can say at least that the film banks heavily in spider imagery. There are intimations of psychological breakdown. We don't really know what's reality and what's fantasy here. And in the end, I guess my question to you, Josh, is this. Is this film an actor's showcase? Is it mainly showing us what Gyllenhaal can do? And is he good enough to really give you two interesting, contrasting characters in this confounding riddle of a picture?
Well, I think that's probably the appeal of the film for him, at least. There's one scene in particular, when you mention that comes to mind, where the actor character is performing in front of a mirror. And it's this very volatile scene, and we're not quite sure if he's being himself or if he's acting. And sure enough, he's rehearsing. And he kind of gives himself a smile at the end of that and says, that was great, something to that effect. So, yeah, Gyllenhaal is having fun with that here. I wouldn't say that it's an acting showcase for him necessarily that reveals new depths. I think he's a fine actor. I've liked him in a lot of things. I don't think it really shoots him to another level. Yet I don't think it's also an indulgent aspect of the movie either, which it easily could have been.
Right.
So I wouldn't hold that against it. But in also considering your description of those three camps who will – watch that ending and come away with certain reactions. I have to say, I'm probably in a fourth, and I think I'll be alone in this camp.
Fourth camp.
It's the camp that just, when that big shock surprise comes, which we will get into, I was sort of like, at that point, this movie had left me so cold,
oh, really?
So uninvolved, that I had not even begun to put forth the effort that was probably required to piece some things together
right.
so that when that shot hit me, I would either be, wow, or what?
Well,
or
okay,
have some sort
thing.
Of engagement. I was not engaged at all by this film.
I hate to be coy about this, but the film that the shot that we can't fully describe here is not handled in sort of a big or melodramatic enough way to kind of force the audience into one reaction. It's sort of a surprise, quote, sting ending. You know?
Uh-huh.
But the film, whether you like it or not, and I liked it more than you did, it sort of glides along in a very methodical rhythm. And
methodical
it's not,
is a good word for it.
Yeah, yeah. Or soporific if you didn't like it. I'd like to talk about Gyllenhaal first.
Sure.
Here's my issue with him. I think this is actually one of the best pieces he's done. And I've often thought he was never quite good enough to match his co-stars in some damn good movies. Brokeback Mountain, for example.
I think
Heath Ledger is just inhabiting so fully and so deeply and so easily that character. Gyllenhaal can just kind of barely keep up, I think. And he sort of is an external actor that never hits more than one note at a time. He's got sort of – I wouldn't call him dexterous. What he is solid, I think. And also one of the key movies of the last 10, 15 years, Zodiac. I think he's a guy who doesn't really – in that film, which I love – he's not really naturally conveying as the newspaper man trying to figure out this mass murder. He doesn't easily convey kind of crazy obsession. What he does is he conveys a lot of wide-eyed sincerity. Now, part of that is just the actor's equipment. He's got wide eyes.
Okay? Uh-huh, yep.
And this is what, you know, among other things he brings to it. And he's got an interesting kind of affable quality. But I think in Enemy,
the key, it seems like, is he had to find a movie where he could co-star with himself.
Maybe so.
And then he doesn't have the competition.
But he's not a bad interactor. He's not one. I don't get a sense that he's this kind of crazy narcissist actor who won't interact with a co-star. I just think I think he doesn't have great dynamic range. And what I like about Enemy, Josh, is that the two Jakes in this film, the history teacher and the actor, they're not wildly or immediately radically different personality types. One is an introvert, one is an extrovert, one's basically sexually confident, one's kind of in a sexual funk, I think. The history teacher's got a relationship going that seems to be sort of all work and no play with Melanie Laurent. And the actor, meantime, has a pregnant wife who somewhat resembles her, played by Sarah Gadon. And once these two characters, and we can say this much, I think, once these two men decide to switch roles for a time, to varying degrees of reluctance or enthusiasm, the film, you know, starts really sort of playing some mind games on it, even beyond the ones they have. Now, why didn't it work for you?
Well, I will say, let me first say about Gyllenhaal is that I did appreciate how he made the distinction between the two characters largely physically, despite the fact that they're exact matches. It was interesting to watch not only what he was wearing, but how he wore the clothes.
An air of confidence.
He gives them distinct airs, and their voices, to purpose, are exactly the same. There's some fun with a phone call that plays with that. So he can't really use his vocal range as a tool here. He has to largely do this out of how he carries himself. And I think he pulled that off fairly well. But as far as why it didn't catch me, it's a puzzle movie. And at some point, these puzzle movies, which I'm certainly open to, and I'm certainly open to films that end without a clear explanation. But the key is not necessarily what that explanation might be or what that final piece might be, but are you engrossed in the process of putting it together?
Right.
And I have to say I was not engrossed really from the start. The first third charts Adam, the history professor's life, and sort of sets it out as a routine. You use the word methodical.
Numbing. It's a numbing routine.
So this is a very purposeful choice that they've made. Yet it crosses that line for me where it becomes numbing to the point of putting me off at a distance. Something even like the cinematography here, the choice to make, it's shot in Toronto, but the skies are slightly yellowy, looks like smog. The interiors for the opening third largely have this. And what it projected to me was a dourness that infected my experience in a negative way. It was almost if the movie was too tired to try any harder. It was like the cinematography wanted to be sepia, but just kind of got exhausted and was like, well, I'll give you this much sepia and the rest of it you'll have to do.
I will say that, I mean, this is the choice you either go with or you don't. The way Villeneuve is working on this, it's reflecting this sort of de-energized state of the history professor who's just kind of grinding through his lectures, you know, over and over and over, and, you know, is basically stuck. And this is not even really portrayed realistically because we're in a dream state visually and otherwise really from the beginning. I mean we can say this too. At the top you're getting a scene that's that's completely wild, about set in this underground sex club that's
right.
Straight out of Eyes Wide Shut, essentially, where these
with
men,
spiders though.
Yeah, where these men are sitting around watching this sort of a woman masturbate on stage, and then there's this silver palette comes out, a platter comes out, and then the lid is revealed off, and then suddenly we have this hairy tarantula that is crushed by a woman in high heels. And so this is the first of many spider images in the film. Now, these are laid out, depending on your taste, either subtly or ridiculously, obviously. But the spiders return. We will at least say that.
They
much.
Do return. And the crazier moments of their return I actually liked. The movie sort of jolted to life a little bit with that.
Yeah.
But overall, the dourness, it gets the movie stuck for me. And it's not just in terms of cinematography. It's also mood. I feel like this whole film was overloaded with this atmospheric and existential import that it wanted to push down upon us. And this only gets heightened once the two characters meet each other. Suddenly, obviously, this would be a jarring experience for anyone, but the film treats it as if this giant hole has been ripped in the time-space continuum and people cannot handle the very concept of having a double. Instead of any sort of curiosity, they immediately go to mental breakdown.
Right.
And it's a heaviness that comes down upon the film. I would have liked at least one little throwaway joke or a brief moment of lightness. I mean, this is as grim in a lot of ways as Prisoners, the previous film that Villeneuve did with Gyllenhaal. That was a movie about child abduction. And so the oppressive dourness of that film made sense to me here. I didn't want Enemy to be a lark, but it is as oppressive in its own way as Prisoners was.
I didn't quite experience it the same way. I mean, I think what you can say is that one film that reminded me of, Josh, is Polanski's The Tenant. Not a film I love, but it's a film that certainly has stuck with me, and that's a portrait of psychological breakdown that you can take either realistically or not. That's got a kind of a feverish spiral to it. Now, this is not that. This is
no
this
one's
is,
feverish
this,
in this
no,
film.
The fever, and but I would say that there is a kind of wit going on, though, in the way that this routinized life of the history professor is kind of laid out in the first half hour. I did find it kind of slyly amusing, just in the way that he's kind of painting this man and maybe the society, which is kind of all the blanks are kind of left open in this one about where we're really living here, just kind of where this guy's life and his a series of traps he's living in, where it might lead him. Now, while I like this film, Josh, I don't have the kind of relationship to it, certainly on the first viewing, that I do with something like David Lynch's Mulholland Drive, which is a confounding riddle of a movie too, but that's got a real sense of unruly life going on, I think. And I think that's a film that will pay off, that does pay off on a second and third viewing. And Lynch was making that one as he went. This is a much more carefully diagrammed and, as you say, kind of plodding, in its rhythm in some ways. But, it's under 90 minutes. This is just barely 90 minutes, I think. And while some have said it's essentially a 30-minute Twilight Zone episode bloated out to the wrong length, I think it's actually at the length and the size it is, it's a successful conundrum. And I think that I wish I could talk about the ending.
we'll get to it in bonus. You're listening to Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson with the Chicago Tribune's Michael Phillips. And I like how you describe Lynch's pictures having this unruly life. I think maybe that's why those puzzle movies work a little bit better for me. There's also, I would argue, a lot more humor in those and in the characterization. You do get the sense that you're in some sort of bizarre alternative universe in Lynch's films. It is our world, but it's not. It's a mirror world in some ways. And Enemy never transported me that far. Mm-hmm. It seemed stuck trudgingly in just enough of our world so that I was never as engrossed as I should have been. This is one of those films I think half of it is on the viewer. You've got to put in the work and at least attempt to try to figure out what they might be doing and what might this mean and pick up on certain dialogue touches that repeat between the two characters. There's a tiny thing involving blueberries as well, whether or not they eat blueberries and does the Adam character eat them or does the Anthony character eat them. And so that's on me if I didn't connect those dots. But I also expect a movie to push me enough to want to connect them. And I guess that's where Enemy sort of fell short.
It's a luller. You know, it lulls you into a state of sort of being quietly spellbound by the thing, as I basically was. I think it succeeds on its own. It's a small, very strange picture. We should say, too, that it's based on a novel by the Portuguese writer José Saramago called The Double. And this is also the writer who gave us the novel Blindness, which made a terrible film a few years back, which, like this one, I think takes place in a slightly alternative universe, intimations of a totalitarian state just on the fringes. Blindness didn't work for me at all as a film, and that's a film that really did die on its feet. And I guess this is kind of what you're saying about Villeneuve's take on the material. But compared to that, this is like the big broadcast of 1938.
And from what I understand, Saramago does not include anything with spiders.
No, there's no spiders.
In the novel. So it's interesting that they did make that choice. And his novels do seem to be based in high concept ideas like this is, and then take them to more philosophical lengths. I wish that Enemy had perhaps pushed that as well. Well, Enemy is currently in limited release. If you check it out, we do want to hear your thoughts about it. Please send those to feedback@filmspotting.net. We also love to get voicemails from listeners. The number to do that is 312-264-0744. You can also find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
So what young inventive director deserves a $100 million budget? You can vote for our choice in the Film Spotting poll up next. Plus, Josh and I share a few thoughts on Muppets Most Wanted.
I heard the budget for Felt alone was $100 million.
Stay with us.
Brief interruption here, everyone. We want to remind you that Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether it's your website, advertisement, multimedia presentation, or some other film project, there are over 1 million high-quality stock video clips, 2D animations, and 3D motion graphics available through Shutterstock. They have clips in a variety of digital formats. Most of these do come in HD. And we do like to hear from listeners who use Shutterstock, how they're employing it in their own creative projects. Got this email from Doug Boyles. So inspired by your thoughtful conversations over the years, I not only began writing about movies, but I'm thrilled to announce that it's resulted in a book. I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed, contains 233 film reviews, all written over the course of 2013. You'll find Oscar contenders, minor offenders, and a few films that should simply be ashamed of themselves. I got my cover photo from Shutterstock.com using the Film Spotting coupon code, of course, and it's gotten a lot of comments from folks that love it. Thanks for the countless hours of conversations. More information is at DougInTheDark.com, which we will link to in the show notes.
Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world and puts them at your fingertips. Many contributors to Shutterstock are professional filmmakers, and each video is reviewed individually for content and quality before adding it to its library. Shutterstock adds 12,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you'll find something new.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock and save your video selections to your clip box. Once you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM314, and new accounts will receive 25% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 25% off new accounts, use offer code FILM314. We thank Shutterstock for their support.
Our family has been chosen for a great task, to save the innocent.
The innocent?
The animals.
Why are they innocent?
Because they still live as they did in the garden.
Yes. We need to save enough of them to start again.
But what of us?
I guess we get to start again too, in a new and better world. First, we have to build.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. We'll get to this week's top five actor-director pairings, plus some thoughts on the new Muppet movie in just a bit. But first, that was Russell Crowe as Noah in the Darren Aronofsky biblical epic of the same name. It's set to be released later this month. Our poll question this week has us considering Aronofsky's leap to big-budget, special effects-heavy filmmaking. Noah's production budget was reportedly around $125 million, dwarfing the indie auteur's budgets for movies like Black Swan, The Wrestler, or Requiem for a Dream. Even his Millennium Spanning the Fountain cost about $35 million to make. That was back in 2006. This got us thinking about other young indie directors that we might entrust with $100 million or so. So this week's film spotting question, pretty basic here, Michael. To which of these young directors, all of whom are film spotting favorites, would you give $100 million or more to direct the epic of their choosing? What options are we giving listeners, Michael?
J.C. Chandor, who made last year's All Is Lost with Robert Redford and also 2011's Margin Call, J.C. Chandor. Derek C. in France, who made The Place Beyond the Pines and Blue Valentine. Sean Durkin of Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. Sarah Polley, who did Stories We Tell, Take This Waltz, and Away From Her. Kelly Reichardt, the director of Meek's Cutoff, Wendy and Lucy, and Old Joy, and Ben Zeitlin of the recent Oscar-nominated Beasts of the Southern Wild. Which of those?
Tough choices there.
So
a couple of these are my favorite younger directors working, and I'm sure listeners would say my immediate pick would be Ben Zeitlin.
Beasts of the Southern Wild was
my favorite film of the year, but I think
you were wrong on it. Didn't you issue a retraction on that opinion?
I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't vote for him here, though, however, because one of the things I appreciated about that film was its low-budget craftiness and how that didn't prevent him from envisioning fantastic things. I liked how he did it on a low budget. I feel like getting more money and more technology would only hamper his vision. So I'm not voting for Ben Zeitlin. Mm. The one I would like to see get this opportunity would be Kelly Reichardt, actually, especially after Meek's Cutoff. Being a period piece like that, taking on a much bigger scale story, I could see her using a budget to do something similar without letting the effects take over. Hmm. How about you, though, Michael? Is there an obvious choice here when you look at this list?
No, you know, there isn't. And this is a really great poll question because you just think everybody's working in such a different style here. And
that's true.
And you don't get the sense with the best work on this list that the directors wished they had had another 20, 50 million to tell the same story. They're telling stories on the right size and the right scale, I think. That said, I just on sheer quality, I would go Sarah Polley because I just think she's a huge talent. And also the way Derek C. France's most recent film, The Place Beyond the Pines, had that kind of scope and breadth. It wasn't necessarily a big budget feel, but he really tells big canvas stories. And I'd be very interested to see what he did in kind of a big sprawling period piece, for example, with a lot of actors. I think he's very good with actors. And in a way, he's the biggest open question on this list and the one I'd be the most interested to see what he did with that money.
Well, that's a good way to think about it. It doesn't necessarily mean special effects. It can mean locations or span of a story or, as you mentioned, actors who are hired as well. Another way of thinking about it would be which of these filmmakers do you think has an epic in them? Who would do the best job of executing that vision? So we want to hear what listeners think. You can vote for that at filmspotting.net. Couple of quick notes here. We did mention in our Enemy review that we wanted to get into some spoilers for that film because It's particularly full of twists or odd happenings and a final shot for sure that it wouldn't be fair to give away if someone hadn't seen it. Michael and I will share our theories as to what it's all about. Do you have a theory, Michael, you can share?
I have the facts.
I don't have a theory. That's even better. And of course, what we did think of that crazy final shot. So that's going to be in bonus content. You can get that through the Film Spotting app, which is available for iPhone, Android phones, and Windows 8 phones. Go to filmspotting.net and click on the apps link for all the details.
Flawlessly executed. Bravo.
What did you expect from world's most dangerous frog and number one criminal number two?
Yeah, I know. You're number one, I'm number two. I think you mentioned that before.
Now that we control the Muppet Tour number two, phase one of our plan is complete. We are now positioned to carry out greatest burglary. Yes, of all time. Pinned on those gullible Muppets who will spend the rest of their miserable lives behind bars.
That was evil Kermit there. Actually, I think the character's name in the film is Constantine, sharing the scene with Ricky Gervais in Muppets Most Wanted. Fittingly for this show, Michael, it's another double movie, which I didn't realize. I knew the Muppets plot when I went into it, but it didn't strike me till I got out of the theater last night that this was another doppelganger movie like Enemy, therefore perfect for the show.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, Josh, right now over at commercial radio, WLS, I think you and I are doing a very different movie show.
Are we really?
So we have our own doppelgangers.
Wow, I bet in that one I really, really liked Enemy.
Yeah, and they get paid over there.
Well, excellent. Yeah. Well, the doppelganger here is the evil Kermit. Kermit gets kidnapped, thrown in a gulag, and Constantine takes over running the Muppet Show. And this is all a cover so that he and Ricky Gervais can steal a series of artifacts from museums across Europe. I'm a huge Muppets fan, Michael, as listeners know. It was just before I joined the show when the last Muppet movie, the reboot, The Muppets, came out, and it ended up making my top 10 list for that year. Partly for nostalgic reasons, I will admit, but I also think it captured the exact spirit of what this enterprise, I don't want to say enterprise or franchise, because it's something that's so homemade and heartfelt when you get to the bottom of it, when it's done well. But the Muppets captured what that was all about, while at the same time just being nonsense. Because at their heart, the Muppets are nonsense, joyful nonsense. It's what I've always appreciated about them. What that means, though, when it comes to other Muppet movies is that I don't give them a free pass. I expect great things. In other words, this is a potential best movie of the year for me when a Muppet film comes out. And Muppets Most Wanted falls far short of that standard. I had a good time. I thought it was fun. It has some good gags. I liked some of the actors who they managed to get to play parts in here. And Constantine was fairly amusing, I thought. But in terms of many of the other elements, nowhere near what the Muppets did. You were at the same screening as I was, Michael. How did you come out of that?
I was in the no laughing section.
Really?
So, yes. I really, really, the film is not necessarily sloppy or lazy. I think the premise for this is potentially workable, Josh, but I just think the whole thing has a bad odor, and a lot of it just turns into kind of James Bond 60s style espionage spoofs with what I think is just a lot of misjudged harshness to it. I mean, maybe I'm a sensitive flower, you know, I admit it. But one of the things that the previous film, The Muppets, with Jason Segel and Amy Adams had going for it is you had two very kind of winning, likable, Muppet-like humans in the middle of this film. And here, it's all adversity and danger and a lot of humans that don't like these guys. And I know that sounds kind of dorky or geeky to object to a movie on that level, but the whole premise, the whole setup of this thing is just that this movie begins as the last movie announces the end and is, okay, folks, that's a wrap. So there's no time elapsing between the previous film and this one. And yet the film, within 5 minutes, is casting the Muppets as perennial losers, no fans, really kind of marginal.
Well,
icon. And the whole thing is depressing.
Okay,
depressing.
I gotta say,
it's more depressing. It's more depressing than Divergent.
I haven't seen that yet, so
depressing.
I'll have to take your word for it. I gotta say, I liked how this opened. I mean, this meta element of referring to their own stardom and their fans has always been a part of the lore, and I did appreciate how they handled it, right down to the extras who play Amy Adams and Jason Segel, but we only see their back.
From the back, yeah,
and they're referencing that. I mean, it really goes down a couple levels, because the whole theme of the last picture was that the Muppets are back. We all love them. Hooray. They deflate that immediately by saying, oh, no, that was just a movie. Really, no one still cares.
Right.
There's a shot of the studio lot and all the extras have gone away. So that I was fine with that. But there's a problem. There is a problem in that the meta-ness can only work if you can keep the joke going. And when there's a line in that opening number about how everyone knows the sequel isn't as good anyway, it's funny then, because yes, that's largely true. But when it turns out to be true this time as well, then the joke is a little bit sour.
It's like the movie's giving itself a free pass.
It's trying to give itself a free pass when the standard should be higher.
Yeah.
So, and you're onto something about the harshness. And I haven't quite been able to put my finger on it exactly yet. But even having this gulag setting, there's not that they shouldn't do that, that there shouldn't be a Muppet movie in prison and play with some of those genre tropes, because they largely do spoof movie genres. But there's
I will say, too, the whole first generation of the Muppet movies, and I didn't see all of them, but a couple of them I really liked. Like the first Muppet movie back in 79, there was a sequel called The Muppets Take Manhattan that was particularly good with Charles Grodin, I believe he was in that.
And, that sounds right. He was in one of them,
they're taking on musicals. They're taking on all kinds of
stuff. So they play with genre a lot. And so that's fair game for them. But how it's handled here is a little curious. There are gags about, the punishment where prisoners are thrown on a wall to hang. There's a recurring gag about someone who sings from a solitary confinement box. And it does have this acid taste. I think I even caught an Anne Frank joke or a line at some point in there. And there's something about these where it's bad taste in a way that doesn't match with the Muppet sensibility quite exactly.
Right. And here's the thing. Here's the previous film, which I thought was pretty good. I didn't like it like you did. But the previous film had a very interesting mixture of snark and sincerity. And I think here, the people who put this together are very talented and have worked on other things that I really admire. James Bobin was one of the chief guys behind the Ali G show and Flight of the Conchords. The co-writer, Nicholas Stoller, did The Five-Year Engagement, which I liked more than apparently everybody in the world, and Get Me to the Greek. But those senses of humor, I think, just simply do not coexist easily with the world of the Muppets. And I think too often, Josh, you just have a movie where it's the Muppets are essentially straight men or straight women or straight critters, whatever you want to say, for all these venal human characters. That's just not – I don't know what young audiences coming to the Muppets for the first time are even going to make out of this thing emotionally or comically.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
We're doing a sequel. We're back by popular demand. Come on, everybody, strike up the band.
We're doing a sequel. That's what we do in Hollywood. And everybody knows that the sequel's never quite as good.
A sequel. Another feature attraction.
Places, please. Light the lights. Roll camera. Action!
I thought it was the end, but no, my friends. This is when we get to do it all again.
Do it all again.
Well, the curious thing, though, is that James Bobin, the director, did the last Muppets movie, where I think that sensibility did match. So there's some consistent creative carryover, which is why it did leave me wondering what was a little off here. Another person returning who I think was instrumental in making the last film work is Brett McKenzie, who comes also from Flight of the Conchords.
He's the songwriter. Yeah, but these songs are not funny.
Well, I like two of them. They are nowhere near the level of Am I a Man or a Muppet, or the opening number from the last film. But I did like the one with Ricky Gervais and Constantine, where the evil frog keeps insisting how Ricky Gervais is number two, and that wants to be his priority, is to let him know that he's below him. And the voice actor of Constantine, Matt Vogel, is very funny here. I think it's quite a funny performance, especially when he tries to mimic Kermit's demeanor and his mannerisms, so that he kind of half-heartedly tries. He doesn't really even want to bother. So there are some good scenes there. I think the number with Miss Piggy and Celine Dion, that captures how Muppet cameos work, because it's at once a parody of the Dion performance and also a big singing performance that works within the story. Some of the other musical numbers, I'll give you, drag a little bit. I could have used much more dancing numbers along the lines of the one from the Muppets that they open the film with. There's a prisoner dance scene here in the Gulag led by Tina Fey. It's amusing that people like Danny Trejo and Ray Liotta are in it, and there are a few good gags involving them, but they do go on a little bit long as well.
I honestly think there's just something a little off with the timing of almost every sight gag and the rhythm of almost every scene, whether it's sort of action-based or dialogue-based. I don't know if it's a matter of the mechanics, the simple mechanics of getting sight gags to work properly when you're dealing with Muppets and humans in the same shot, but there's one that really stuck with me just because it was such a wincer, and that, you know, there's a train chugging along and the Muppet engineer is getting clonked on the head by various things, crossing signals and all that, and it's not funny. It doesn't play like a sight gag. It just plays like violence, and I mean, that kind of tone is just like where you see where I'm supposed to laugh. None of it's quite clicking the way it should, and it just makes me realize, A, how hard it is to film any kind of screen comedy and any kind of sight gag properly, any kind of slapstick. And B, I just think if you treat the Muppets like just basically straight men and women, like I say, for a lot of other less interesting human characters, you don't have much of a movie.
Well, if you do see the Muppets this weekend, because it is opening wide, let us know what you think. Better yet, if your kids go with you and this is their first Muppets experience, I'd like to hear, as Michael suggested, what they made of the film. You can email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Or you can find us on Twitter at filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Even though they've made two films together now, it's safe to say Kermit the Frog and James Bobin won't make either of our lists of the best actor-director pairings of all time. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Donation time here on Film Spotting, in which a couple of listeners who have donated are going to lay a major guilt trip on other listeners.
Excellent.
We'll get to that in just a minute. A note here about our music. We're pairing it with this week's top five, which is actor-director duos. So we're focusing on a couple of composer-director duos. You heard music from Bernard Herrmann's score to Hitchcock's Vertigo. Herrmann did, of course, score 8 of Hitch's films. And we'll also hear the main titles from Danny Elfman's score to Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands. Burton and Elfman worked together at least 10 times. The only films they haven't collaborated on, Burton's adaptation of Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, that makes sense, and Ed Wood, which was actually scored by Howard Shore. All right, let's get to our donations this week, which starts with this note from platinum-level donor Stacey Oleski-Lock from Victoria, British Columbia. I just listened to your 2013 wrap party and am reminded of how very overdue I am in sending a gift of appreciation for years of entertainment. Scanning your archives, I would guess my first episode was number 180 from October 2007, wherein Adam and Maddie panned the assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford and praised 310 to Yuma.
Wait a minute. They both didn't like Robert Ford?
That sounds off to me.
Wow. Were they even here? Did they even see?
I had nothing to do with any of that.
All right.
Stacey continues, since then, I've enjoyed all kinds of your shows, from glowing reviews to battles of opinion to expressions of disappointment. I'm now mommy to 2 young daughters, so I don't have as many chances to listen, but Film Spotting does make washing dishes after they're in bed much more fun. I'm estimating 150 episodes at your suggested buck a show. Thanks again, and I look forward to many more years of listening. Well, thank you, Stacey. Very, very generous. We also want to say thanks to Leanna from Beloit, Wisconsin, who signed up for $10 a month donation.
She writes, I've been an avid listener since the Dark Knight episode in the spring of 2005. I think I have a Sam nickname, but I was hoping for something grittier, so it slipped my mind. Film Spotting is the North Star in my podcast constellation for all these years, remaining my one unbroken subscription as my tastes and habits have changed. It's helped me travel thousands of car commuting and road trip miles and endure endless crappy business flights.
Leanna continues, after stints in Tacoma, Seattle, and Madison, I sold my car last year and moved to China for my job. film spotting is more important than ever, and now helps me enjoy the rare experience that is a Shanghai metro station at rush hour. I also walk many exploratory miles in this teeming city, and you guys can still make me laugh out loud at the most inopportune times. Today, I'm catching up on donations. I'm covering a buck a show since Film Spotting 300 in 2010, and going forward, I'm a monthly subscriber. As the whole podcast universe has developed, I'm more aware than ever that some things are worth paying for. Film spotting is still the conversation I wish I was having, now more than ever as I try to master the basics in Mandarin. Hopeless, by the way. Thank you for all you do. Thank you, Leanna. Thank you, Stacy. And we want to thank all of our monthly donors. We won't make those of you who haven't donated feel guilty, though. We'll just say thanks for listening.
Josh, is it possible for people to actually individually sponsor guest co-hosts?
I think we might want to open that up.
I think so.
A new marketing and financial stream opportunity here.
It's a possibility.
I like it. Do you have any particular products in mind, corporations you'd like to be sponsored by?
No, just strictly
individuals.
General operating
kind of
funding.
A Kickstarter for Michael Phillips.
Yeah, that's right.
I like it.
Hi, this is Lynn Shelton, director of Hump Day and Your Sister Sister. You are listening to Film Spotting.
We go charging in, they'll kill her, and you know it.
That's what I'm counting on.
I know you are. Well, it ain't gonna be that way. She's alive, and she's gonna stay alive.
Living with Comanches ain't being alive.
Better she's alive and living with Comanches and her brains bashed out.
Now, son, I know this is a bitter thing to say, but there's more at stake here than your sister.
There sure is. I'm gonna tell you something. Didn't mean to speak of it, but I'm gonna tell you now. You remember that scalp strung on Scar's lance? Long,
yeah,
and wavy?
Yeah, I saw it, and don't try to tell me it was Aunt Martha's or Lucy's.
It was your mother's.
Come on, son.
But that don't change it. That don't change nothing.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Michael Phillips. I'm Josh Larson. You may not agree that they're the best actor-director duo, but they were certainly the most productive. That was John Wayne there as Ethan Edwards in John Ford's The Searchers, one of 21 films that the two worked on together. It is time now for the Film Spotting Top 5. This week, tied into Enemy, which was Jake Gyllenhaal's second film with director Denis Villeneuve, but also The Muppets opening this weekend, which is James Bobin's reuniting with Kermit the Frog. Actor-director duos is a topic that Film Spotting has tackled before. Adam and Maddie did this in 2008, back on episode number 215. Taking a look at those lists, not only did Adam have John Wayne and John Ford, but he named his list the De Niro Scorsese Memorial, set that one aside, and a couple other picks here, which I'm just going to mention because I gave them serious consideration and didn't end up putting them on my list just because Adam had mentioned them. Toshiro Mifune and Akira Kurosawa, James Stewart and Alfred Hitchcock. That's probably the one that came first to my mind. And then looking at Maddie's list, he had one in particular I thought about, Philip Seymour Hoffman working with Paul Thomas Anderson. We spent a lot of time on our Philip Seymour Hoffman tribute show talking about the wonderful work those two did together. So some I considered ended up going a different direction. Michael, I don't know if any of those are on your list, but maybe talk about how you did put this one together, because we're looking at not only all of movie history, which is rich with such collaborations, but trying to rank those. I'm glad I had that out a little bit in Adam and Maddie's previous list, so yeah. I didn't feel quite so pressured to cover it all.
I mean, I guess more than a lot of the categories we've talked about on this show, either with you, Josh, or just with you and Adam, this one, we're spoiled for choice. The idea of ranking these is kind of unseemly and ridiculous.
As it is every week, really.
But I don't know why this one seems harder than usual for me to really get into, like, well, what's number three and what's number five? There's no question about the historical importance of the pairing of John Ford and John Wayne in so many different types of films. It's not on my list for purely subjective reasons. It's although I revere a lot of John Ford's work, I'm strictly going with the movies I return to and the performances I return to with certain directors for pleasure, for pure pleasure. To my grave, I will be struggling with why I don't revere the Western genre as highly as I do many other film genres, although there's plenty of Westerns that I do feel really personally connected to, and that'll be in one of mine, at least one of my five. But, yeah, it's just It's not about historical importance for me. It's purely favorites.
All right. With that in mind, what's your number five?
My number five is a very kind of modest pairing. It's the most contemporary of the five I ended up with, and that's the films of Jeff Nichols made with Michael Shannon. And again, it's purely personal. This Michael Shannon is an actor that I saw on Chicago stages in various theater productions for years as a theater critic before he had really hit it in the movies. And I just thought this guy's got an extraordinary range. Although even then, even a decade ago, Josh, he was being, I think, unfairly typecast as the psycho and the guy who plays whoever's going to upset the apple cart in any given situation. But then I started seeing more and more plays where Shannon could really just show off what he can do. You know, just a really formidable technical actor, very good with different dialects, different character types. And then in the films of Jeff Nichols, most recently he played a supporting role in Mud, a film I think we both liked a great deal. Mm-hmm. You look at Shotgun Stories, where he's really the center of the action there. And, of course, Take Shelter with Jessica Chastain, where you have two really fiercely terrific performances anchoring that. These two are communicating, and this is what you look for, I think, in an actor-director pairing. Whatever kind of story is being told, whatever sort of genre the film may or may not fit into, you want to have a sense that if an actor is working with that same director more than once, that there's a reason other than just they enjoy each other's company, that the director, who's often very often the writer as well or the co-writer, is finding that actor is uniquely attuned to the kind of dialogue and the kind of visual storytelling that they're after. And I think Nichols, while he's not a flashy visual stylist, he's telling the kind of stories in Take Shelter and Mud, and hopefully, you know, we'll get dozens more in the future, and hopefully a lot of them with Shannon, that I just feel authentic and very much of the heartland in a way that doesn't make me sick to my stomach in terms of nostalgia or, you know, sort of the wrong kind of faux sincerity. I just find that Shannon, thanks to Jeff Nichols, Shannon has been able to show that he's got kind of an interior life that can be brought. It's not all General Zod.
Yeah, right. Well, talking about Shannon's early career, too, we didn't get a chance to touch on this when we reviewed Groundhog Day to the Sacred Cow a few weeks back.
And there he is.
He was in that diner scene. I didn't remember that. And watching it again, the scene where Bill Murray talks to all of the patrons in the diner.
And he's the young groom-to-be.
Right. The groom-to-be is upset when there's cold feet there. I noticed that, too. And, yeah, Shannon and Nichols are both film-spotting favorites. And revealing of that is the fact that when I heard about Mud and saw that Shannon just had a supporting part, a little bit of me went, oh, because I wanted him to have, you know, it's good for directors to work with other actors, obviously, but I was still on such a high from Take Shelter. I wanted that to be another tour de force opportunity.
But also, weren't you relieved and gratified that in Mud, the part played by Shannon is just a sort of shambling, low-key.
And he serves it well.
Amiable guy.
Yes, yes.
And because Shannon's an interesting and complicated screen presence, and just a really first-rate actor, he brings kind of this unspoken undercurrent of sort of ordinary scenes.
And I think that speaks to the trust an actor and director have, too, is that one will be able to take a smaller part in a future film and not try to go too far with it.
Yeah.
You know, that he's there to serve the film, so that certainly comes out in their pairings. For my number five, I'm going to also go with a contemporary pick, and it's Johnny Depp and Tim Burton. And these two have burned so many bridges in recent years that this is not going to be a popular pick. I already know this from talking to people on Facebook and Twitter about this topic. Alice in Wonderland is especially dreadful. Dark Shadows, I found largely uninspiring, some interesting things going on in the edges. And Depp, for his part, has certainly taken this penchant for oddity outside of the Burton realm. I mean, don't blame Burton for The Lone Ranger. What's going on there? But if you consider their pre-Alice body of work, I think it does speak very strongly to a unique creative partnership.
What are you really jazzed about personally?
What I'm really jazzed about, Ed Wood and Edward Scissorhands. I think those are the two pinnacle films for them. But even something like Sweeney Todd, you could argue that it took their particularly well-matched sensibilities to make a movie version of the Sondheim musical work. I am a fan of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. I know it's not as good as the Gene Wilder version. Few films are, but it did capture.
Wait a minute! I have no love for the old.
You have no love for the old. Oh, Michael!
I have qualified interest.
Do you like the Burton version better?
I'm just okay on that too. I love that. I love the Roald Dahl book.
I love that book too much. Yeah. Well, I think that the Burton version, I think it still does manage to capture that whimsical misery of Dahl in its own unique way. So yeah. I have a place for both of those films. Mm-hmm. Wilder obviously gives a better performance than Depp, but Depp's still doing interesting things. And don't discount something like Corpse Bride, which is Burton's eerie, beautiful 2005 stop motion film, largely forgotten in his filmography. But Depp gives a very delicate vocal performance there. But yeah, let's get to Ed Wood, which is one of Burton's best films.
That's my favorite of theirs. That's my favorite of theirs.
I think also probably Depp's funniest performance. And then Edward Scissorhands, I do consider it to be Burton's masterpiece to this day. And much of that really has to do with the pantomime pathos that Depp brings to that part.
Those are your hands? Those are your hands. What happened to you? Where are your parents? Your mother? Your father?
He didn't wake up.
In the beginning of their career around that time, Edward Scissorhands, they may have seemed like a really odd pair considering where Depp was coming from. It was almost like the weird goth kid in high school suddenly befriended the prom king. And there was no way this is going to work. But they've managed to give us this handful of wonderful movies that I don't think anyone else could have. So for that, they're my number five.
I think for a lot of these picks, Josh, too, I'm looking at two or three pairings that really live with me still, and not necessarily the entire body of work, but that's yeah.
Not everything has to work, yeah. But why get a couple that are just magic, there's something there in the alchemy between them.
So why is the Ed Wood performance that Johnny Depp gives, why is that his loosest, not just funniest, but kind of the most interesting and most spontaneous performance he ever gave?
Doesn't he seem to be having the most fun there?
Maybe that is.
It seems like there's something just loose about that whole film that captures the chaos of filmmaking itself and the improvisation of sets. And Depp doesn't seem like he has any pressure to make that movie or that character work for himself. He's there just having fun, and it really comes through on the screen.
Yeah. I got to say, those sweaters do look comfortable.
Yeah, I think it was the sweaters. Huh? What was your number four pick?
My number four is a lighthearted pick, Ingmar Bergman and Liv Ullmann's work together.
Yes, yes.
We can talk about...
a little less grim than the recent Muppets. Huh?
That's right. Just slightly, though. Bergman did amazing work with all kinds of actors, a lot of whom we worked with in the theater earlier on. I mean, just as you could just as easily swap in Bergman's work with Max von Sydow from The Seventh Seal onward. But I think with Ullmann, he found, and it was a very complicated kind of tortured relationship, both off screen and on. But with Ullmann, he really found the conduit for the kind of existential and emotional dilemmas that he was so good at exploring. And the film I really would love for people to discover, if they don't know yet, is Bergman's Shame, which stars Ullmann and von Sydow, who I think I'm mispronouncing, but there you go. This is a lesser-known great film from Bergman that's set just vaguely in the very near future, and there's sort of an unnamed, undetailed war going on, and it's just basically how wartime affects this couple, and it's a tale of infidelity, among other things. But it's got a very very different quality for Bergman. It doesn't have that kind of diagrammed, studied, fierce, careful composition. It feels a little looser, a little rougher hewn, I'd say. But the performances are pure magic and pure truth. And it's a film. It's probably my favorite Bergman film, and it's certainly the one of the great ones, as I say, that's the least known. And I think it's probably the peak in their collaboration in Ullmann's work with Bergman. So see it if you haven't. And, Bergman's may not be the filmmaker that I cherish the most in my life, but it's when you think of all the amazing work he's done with serious themes that don't die as cinema. A lot of seriously intentioned filmmakers simply don't have movie making in them the way Bergman does.
My number four is also a non-American pairing, though a little bit more recent than Ullmann and Bergman. It is Tony Leung and Wong Kar-wai. They've made seven films together, and those do include In the Mood for Love, Chungking Express, Happy Together, and then last year's The Grand Master. And just looking at Leung physically, he almost seems as if he's been molded by Wong from Clay just specifically to be in his movies. I mean, he perfectly matches the director's mise-en-scène, which is defined by stillness, I think, and elegance and these gorgeous surfaces. These are recurring elements in his films, and Leung does fit there really well. But he is more than a perfect model. I mean, that makes him sound a little bit like a well-matched prop, and I think it does go beyond that in their films together. His face often projects this quiet longing, which is a key component to so many of Wong's films. With only imperceptible expressions, Leung can make us feel all these roiling emotions and turmoil that's going on underneath. And I think that's in sync really with how Wong's images overall often do work. There are these pristine surfaces that are masking a world of tremors. There's real drama, there's real emotion that's going on underneath what he's showing us right there on the screen. If I had a representative film to recommend, it would be In the Mood for Love, which I've talked about before on the show. It's a 2000 drama about a man and a woman who are neighbors and suspect their respective spouses are having an affair. And that to me is just, that performance by Leung is the epitome of how he services the films that Wong imagines.
In a funny way, your pick there is maybe the, even though it's not Hollywood, it's the most sort of old Hollywood of the
It has that feel.
It's
yeah, got, their films do.
Yeah, it's got, you know, he's using them like a really well-regarded, you know, highly prized studio contract player, you know, and the actor and the director speak the same language.
That they do. We are listing our top five actor-director pairings of all time connected with this week's opening and limited release of Enemy, which pairs Jake Gyllenhaal again with his Prisoners director, Denis Villeneuve. We are at number three. Michael, what do you have in that slot?
Well, I think also in honor of the doppelganger theme this week with the Muppet movie.
That's true.
You have
the Muppets
Kermits,
get in on
two Kermits. You got two Jake Gyllenhaals. My number three is Orson Welles directing Orson Welles. That's one of my favorite actor-director pairings right from the first. Citizen Kane, when you look at the performance he's giving under his own direction, and it continued, this relationship continued all the way through, I think most fruitfully, Chimes at Midnight in the 60s, where he plays Falstaff in a film that is very messy and in many ways technically compromised in terms of sound quality and other things. I adore what Welles is doing as Falstaff in that film, though, and that I think it took him that long to discover a kind of quietude and simplicity in performing for the camera. You know, I mean, also one of the great moments certainly for Welles on screen in any film, whether one of his own or not, is Touch of Evil, where he's playing the most corrupt cop along the Mexico-U.S. border, Hank Quinlan.
In any free country, a policeman is supposed to enforce the law, and the law protects the guilty as well as the innocent.
Our job is tough enough.
It's supposed to be. It has to be tough. A policeman's job is only easy in a police state. That's the whole point, Captain. Who is the boss, the cop or the law?
Where's your wife, Frank?
What do you mean? You know where she is as well as I do. Sergeant Menzies drove her. She's at the motel.
Huh? You're still here?
Yes, I'm checking out now and joining her. Do you have a reason?
No special reason, no. I just wondered.
And that's a film I fell in love with as a high school kid just because I'd never seen anything quite that sleazy, quite that tawdry. And it's just the greatest B-movie ever made. Welles, as a director, is often very hard on actors because he's so aggressive and stylized in terms of what we're looking at and how and the angles by which we're looking at it. There's just actors have to kind of step up and compete with Welles's directorial attack, and nobody could do it better than Welles himself. He really knew how to fill a frame, often just physically, in terms of like Hank Quinlan in Touch of Evil, or Falstaff a decade later. But he had the kind of theatrical brio as an actor that he also brought to his work behind the camera. And I think the results, you look at the best three or four, the results were just inspired.
That seems right to describe it as a competition, actually, because you do get the sense in some of those films, and probably Touch of Evil more than any other, of the director Welles upping the ante with his filmmaking and the actor Wells having to respond, having to say, oh, yeah, you're going to do that? Well, then watch this.
Well, watch me eat this candy bar.
Exactly.
In a way that could only be, you know, only be done by me.
It's just so fun to see that back and forth. Well, I don't know, Michael, that may be a cheap pick. You're kind of trying to pull something here. I will submit that to the Film Spotting corporate attorney and we'll get a ruling. For now, we'll allow it.
You're going legal on me. Very nice.
My number three is going to be Penelope Cruz and Pedro Almodovar, who made Volver together, Broken Embraces, All About My Mother, and a handful of other films. They were both fairly well established in their careers before they began working together. Cruz had already gone off for a stint in Hollywood by the time of 1999's All About My Mother. That was not their first film together. Live Flesh was their first film, but it was their first major collaboration, I would say. And in researching some of this, I came across a 2009 Guardian interview where Almodovar had something interesting to say about watching Cruz work in America. She got to Hollywood very quickly, and everybody wanted to work with her. Because she is very beautiful, it became more to do with that. She became a fashion icon, and they didn't care if she was a good actress or not. That's what I don't like about Hollywood. They never conceive of giving an actor something unusual. They have to be safe in everything that they do. I think what's revealing about her work with Almodovar is that he enabled her to do the opposite of that when they did work together. I mean, if you think about All About My Mother, she plays a pregnant nun. That's not exactly a Hollywood conventional role. Their triumph film, in my opinion, together is Volver, though, in which Cruz plays a working class wife and mother in Madrid who gets caught up in a murder plot. It's sort of their nod to Hitchcock. And his pairings with Grace Kelly, perhaps. I think it's interesting you talked about Tony Leung being a classic Hollywood actor and Wong Kar-wai using him that way. I think Almodovar very much uses Cruz as a classic Hollywood screen goddess in this film while also rooting the story in the real world. She does give this Hollywood performance, but she brings both glamour and grit to it. So my number three is Penelope Cruz, Pedro Almodovar.
Good pick.
How about you at number two, Michael?
This is tough, but I went with Katharine Hepburn working with George Cukor in films, among others, many films in the 30s. But my favorite is the collaboration they did together with Cary Grant on the 1938 film version of Holiday. And that's a film that precedes the better known and widely loved The Philadelphia Story by 2 years. Both come from plays by Philip Barry. And Hepburn in Holiday plays the sister of a woman who's engaged to marry this carefree, wealthy young stockbroker, Johnny Case, played by Cary Grant, who wants to basically retire at age 30 and then maybe go to work later when he's 50 or so. And it's a play that came out of the late 20s before the crash, before the Depression. And by the time the movie rolled around, it all seemed a little, I think, to audiences of the day, just kind of irrelevant and frivolous. And why are these rich people's problems anything to do with me? Blah, 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 that kind of thing. I think decades hence, though, Josh, this thing seems timelessly funny and really serious in its kind of exploration about what is going to make a marriage work and what might undermine it from the beginning. And I think the work that Cukor gets out of Hepburn in this is the most, it's the first time audiences may have seen her as a truly vulnerable and kind of heartbroken character. She had by that time played all kinds of different parts, mostly period films, a lot of them with Cukor. But the work in Holiday, and then I think later maybe capped by The Philadelphia Story, is just proves that Cukor was not just a, quote, woman, a great woman's director, which was kind of the rap on Cukor at the time. And it's also what got him kicked off of Gone with the Wind, many say, because he just wasn't enough. He couldn't handle Clark Gable or whatever. It's a peak Hollywood film. And like a lot of Hollywood films, Josh, especially from that time, it didn't really catch on with the audience of the day. But the day is really now.
You see, Case, the trouble with me is that I never could decide whether I wanted to be Joan of Arc, Florence Nightingale, or John L. Lewis.
What's the matter? You fed up?
To the neck.
What do you mean with this million-dollar museum, all those marble pillars down there?
Case, compared to the life I lead, the last man in a chain gang thoroughly enjoys himself.
Well, maybe what you need is some time off from what you've been doing, you know, day in, day out.
You mean from what I've not been doing, days in, please, years out.
I think Holiday is quite a less flattering look at affluent life than something like the Philadelphia Story. Actually, it has a lot of bite to it, and a lot of that has to do with Hepburn.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. Philadelphia Story sort of macks on the wealth a little harder than Holiday does.
Yep. Yeah. Well, my number two involves one of the stars of Holiday, actually. It's Cary Grant and his work with Alfred Hitchcock. I'm going to give a nod here to Adam's pick of James Stewart and Hitchcock. I think that's the right one. If I had to choose, I would definitely go there. But his pairings with Grant, they're nothing to sneeze at. You've got Suspicion, which played with Grant's heroic image a bit. Maybe some argue it didn't play with it quite enough and could have pushed that a little bit further. Still very good film. Notorious is the tragic romance, really more romance than a thriller, I'd say, with Grant and Ingrid Bergman as spies and potential lovers who mostly torture each other throughout the film. I think it's Grant's seething jealousy in that picture that makes it work more than Bergman, for me at least. They also made To Catch a Thief together, which is something of a lark for Hitchcock. And Grant does at first seem a bit on automatic. He plays this charming retired cat burglar. But then he and Grace Kelly start generating sparks and Grant really does come alive.
John, tell me something. You're going to rob that villa we cased this afternoon, aren't you? Oh, I suppose rob is archaic. You'd say knock over?
Oh.
Don't worry, I'm very good at secrets.
Tell me, have you ever been on a psychiatrist's couch?
Don't change the subject. I know the perfect time to do it. Next week the Sanfords are holding their annual gala. Everyone who counts will be there. I'll get you an invitation. It's an 18th century costume affair. There'll be thousands upon thousands of dollars worth of the world's most elegant jewelry. Some of the guests will be staying for the weekend. We'll get all the information and we'll do it together. What do you say?
My only comment would be highly censorable.
Give up, John. Admit who you are. Even in this light, I can tell where your eyes are looking.
North by Northwest, in that one you could say the crop duster is the star, but what I like about Grant's performance is it's definitely comic as Roger Thornhill, the man who's mistaken for a spy. So I wouldn't say that any of these are probably Rear Window or Vertigo, Hitchcock's pairings with James Stewart, but still not a bad handful of films.
They had I think, Josh, I think Cary Grant and Alfred Hitchcock had very complementary senses of humor.
Mm.
That's, you wouldn't necessarily say that of Stewart.
Right, you don't think of humor, that's true.
Yeah, and when you see Stewart, I remember seeing Rear Window when it finally, it was out of circulation for a while, and they finally got theatrical releases back in the 80s, I believe. And that was the first James Stewart performance that really took the back of my head off in Rear Window. And it's not because of the comic relief stuff. It's when you have scenes where Stewart is looking across the way and he's unable to help Grace Kelly when Raymond Burr is about to come back to his own apartment. Mm-hmm. She's sneaking around in there. The anguish he goes through is just something that you don't – I had never seen from Stewart at that point because I just hadn't seen enough yet. And that's but Grant's work with Hitchcock – You just know that they were smiling at the same things on the set, and I think that kind of debonair, simpatico sense is just all over everything they did.
Well, that brings us to our number one pick for actor director pairings. Michael, who do you have?
I've got Cary Grant again.
Cary Grant,
but now with Hitchcock, with Howard Hawks.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And they made five films together, three of which I think are amazing. The other two, I Was a Male War Bride from 1949, Monkey Business 1952, a broader kind of sex comedy, I guess you call it. And, you know, it's certainly interesting in different ways, both films. But the work that Hawks and Grant did together just in a very short period of time, Bringing Up Baby, 1938, Only Angels Have Wings a year later, and then the pinnacle, I think, His Girl Friday, 1940. That's, you look at those three films, Josh, back to back, and I defy anybody to say Cary Grant is always the same in every picture, even if they happen to like him. That's always the rap we have against the most revered of our movie stars. That, you know, John Wayne, always the same. Whatever.
They're just playing a persona. They're not
playing themselves, whatever. And really, with any movie star worth his or her salt, that's not true to begin with. But it's particularly not true with people like Stewart and Cary Grant, I think, because when you look at the kind of arch, brittle, high style, almost otherworldly kind of comic exaggeration of Bringing Up Baby, and just the fact that he's such a good physical comedian. And that film was very kind of off-putting and big flop with audiences in the day in 38. Only Angels Have Wings, more dramatic role, but the work there is the subtlest he'd ever done, I think, and the most interior, the moodiest, I think. I think Hawks really had a way of just stripping away the BS from almost every performer. With His Girl Friday, you have a mixture of every kind of Cary Grant there ever was. You have high, medium, and low comic wiles kind of all competing with each other. You know, amazing verbal dexterity with Rosalind Russell. The fact that they got that, I've said this before on this show, but the fact that they got essentially a gender-switched version of the play, the front page done, a three-hour play done in about 87 minutes, is still a miracle of pacing to me. And it's, I don't know, I continue to say that I think the performances you get in His Girl Friday with Grant and Rosalind Russell, it's like Beatrice and Benedict from Much Ado About Nothing. I mean, it's that great. And Hawks is the reason. He's my favorite. A lot of people really do put John Ford at the very top of every list, not just for historical importance in Hollywood, but just the filmmaker that speaks most directly to them. And I think I've always considered Hawks, you know, more that way for me over someone like Ford. So anyway, the work these two did together just thrills me.
Well, how long is it?
How long is what?
You know what? How long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda. About 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
No, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Ah, yes, I would. I'd know you anytime, any place.
Anywhere. Ah, you're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made the night you proposed.
Yeah, I noticed you still remember it.
Of course I remember it. If I didn't remember it, I wouldn't have divorced you.
Yeah, so I wish you hadn't done that, Hildy.
Done what?
Divorce me. Makes a fella lose all faith in himself. Almost gives him a feeling he wasn't wanted.
Oh, now, look, Junior, that's what divorces are for.
Well, you can't go wrong buttressing your pick with His Girl Friday, one of my favorite films as well. I did go in a different direction, though. Still classic Hollywood to a degree, a little bit older period, but it's Billy Wilder and Jack Lemmon.
Oh, good.
When I looked at my finalists for this list and just compared where the films they made together stand, I had to put these two at the top for two of their movies alone, Some Like It Hot and The Apartment. Some Like It Hot has Lemmon and Tony Curtis as musicians. They're on the run from the mob, disguise themselves as women and join this female jazz band. Yes, it's a drag comedy, but if you watch Lemmon's performance here, it's remarkable how little of the humor comes from the cross-dressing. I mean, it's not a shtick performance, and I don't think this is a shtick film, even though there's some of that in it. And then look at The Apartment, which I think is the best representation of the persona that Wilder and Lemmon did establish together, and that's the dork as romantic comedy hero. I mean, we still have that. It's fairly common today, but they really kind of cemented that as a legitimate screen character with The Apartment. This has Lemmon as a peon at an insurance company. He lends his apartment to executives for their midday trysts. And Lemmon is adept at the farce. This movie has some of that. But I think Wilder also brings out the melancholy that lies behind the joking. And that's really one of the key reasons why this movie is a masterpiece.
See, you bought some napkins.
Yeah, might as well go all the way. Yeah, I used to live like Robinson Crusoe. I mean, shipwrecked among 8 million people. And then one day I saw a footprint in the sand. And there you were. It's a wonderful thing. Dinner for two?
You usually eat alone?
Oh, no. Sometimes I have dinner with Ed Sullivan. Sometimes Dinah Shore, Perry Como. The other night I had dinner with Mae West. Of course, she was much younger then. Cheers.
Cheers.
Of the other seven pictures they made together, you've got The Front Page, you've got The Fortune Cookie, and you've got Avanti. But really, after Some Like It Hot in The Apartment, I didn't even need any others for them to make my list.
Right.
So,
Irma LaDuce.
That's another one.
It came just after that. It was a huge hit. And that's not nearly the kind of film that's not worth wrestling with, the way those two films really continue to inspire people.
Yeah, those are two of the greats. Now, how about honorable mentions? You talked about how difficult this list was for you, Michael. Are there a couple that almost made it onto your list?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely what you said before about Paul Thomas Anderson and Philip Seymour Hoffman, and it's not just because Hoffman happened to die recently. The work is amazing, and the fact that Hoffman and Anderson went out together on The Master, that's one of Hoffman's final performances, is just a testament to how simpatico they really were. I think, you know, the toughest in terms of old Hollywood for me, if you look at James Stewart and Anthony Mann and the films they made together, largely Westerns, I think it was eight films together overall. And that that just personally, that meant a lot to me to find films like The Naked Spur and Winchester 73 finally, because I was slow to come to Westerns as a genre. I was, for some reason, I never considered Stewart one of the top flight Hollywood stars until I saw the work there, because you have such vulnerable, tortured, and knotted up protagonists in the middle of those, especially the Westerns they did. It's not the kind of taciturn heroics that I kind of resist in some ways in Westerns. It's a real kind of living, breathing human being in the middle of it. And I think Mann's very kind of unfussy way with just shooting interesting landscapes in a way that goes way beyond postcard imagery, mm-hmm. keeps a good focus on the people at the center, especially Naked Spur. People should see that if they haven't, especially also for Robert Ryan's performance as this cackling antagonist. Amazing work. And Stewart and Mann, that was a tough pairing to overlook.
Well, I have a couple honorable mentions as well. In addition to the Adam and Maddie picks that I mentioned at the top and would certainly agree with, looking at classic Hollywood, Humphrey Bogart and John Huston with The Maltese Falcon and The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, I thought about James Stewart and Frank Capra, because I'm one of those people who goes for It's a Wonderful Life and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. Their sensibilities working together there are key. When you think of comedy greats, we spent some time talking about Blazing Saddles, which was a supporting part for Gene Wilder, but his work with Mel Brooks there.
Good luck.
And in addition to Young Frankenstein, the producers had to give that pair some consideration. And then a couple of contemporary names that probably just too soon to make a list like this, but perhaps down the road, Bill Murray and Wes Anderson.
Oh, yeah.
We talked a lot about them on our recent Grand Budapest show. Michael Fassbender and Steve McQueen, three fantastic films they've already made together. And then I'll just throw this one out there to make people angry, Will Ferrell and Adam McKay. I mean, Ferrell's films with McKay, they're his best.
Yeah, they are.
Talladega Nights.
Yeah, I'm not that crazy about that, but the first Anchorman.
You like that one better?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's a pairing that works with me.
You know, another pairing, it kind of goes back to the Cary Grant Hawks thing for me that I wish I'd had room for, is Grace Kelly and Hitchcock. Because I don't love that one. You know, I don't love Dial M or To Catch a Thief, which you mentioned earlier, the way I love a lot of Hitchcock films. But the Rear Window performance is truly major, I think.
And
the chemistry between Stewart and Kelly is fantastic. And I just – Rear Window is one of my great half dozen from Hitchcock. And I think like Grant, I think Grace Kelly had a sense of humor that was very much in sync with the kind of dark – comedy that Hitchcock gravitated to naturally.
Well, I hinted at it. I think Kelly is the reason To Catch a Thief actually works. She's the one who kind of brings that picture to life. So yeah, I did give her some consideration too. Those are our top five actor-director pairings. We want to hear your picks. You can send those or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting. Couple of movies in limited release here in Chicago this weekend. We have Bad Words, which is directed and starring Jason Bateman as an adult competing in a school spelling bee. Blood Ties is set in 70s-era Brooklyn, involves two brothers who find themselves on opposite sides of the law, as frequently happens in the movies. The cast there, Clive Owen, Billy Crudup, Marion Cotillard, and Mila Kunis. Le Weekend is opening with Jim Broadbent and Lindsay Duncan as a couple celebrating their 30th anniversary in Paris. Jeff Goldblum also makes an appearance there. And then Nymphomaniac Volume 1. This is Lars von Trier's infamous 4-hour film about the titular nymphomaniac and her many lovers.
Are there many?
Oh, you've seen Volume 1 already.
There's several lovers.
So we can say several. We can confirm several lovers.
There are multiple.
In Volume 1, who knows what's ahead in Volume 2? It has been split into two parts. We're going to save our review for the Chicago release of Part 2. That's coming up in early April. The cast there, Charlotte Gainsbourg, Uma Thurman, Shia LaBeouf, and Stellan Skarsgård, among many others. Wide releases, Muppets Most Wanted and Divergent, which is set in a dystopian Chicago that divides people by personality type. This is based on the Divergent trilogy by Chicago writer Veronica Roth. Divergent might be the film we review next week, Michael. We're leaning that way, mostly because we have not heard whether or not we're going to have a chance to see Noah before we do record the next show. So Noah is a possibility, otherwise Divergent. That means the top five is up in the air. So if listeners have suggestions for either of those films, feel free to send those to feedback@filmspotting.net.
I mean, there's flooding issues with Noah. That's what I think they're tending to the flooding
top
issues.
Top five movie floods and or floods. Plumbing problems.
Plumbing problems.
That sounds potentially more fruitful.
Look at Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, the show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everybody at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Michael Phillips.
And I'm Josh Larson. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.